Good afternoon and welcome to the 2020 Fair Lending Interagency Webinar. I'm Jean Rourke with the Center for Learning Innovation at the St. Louis Fed, and I'll be your moderator. Shortly, I'll turn our call over to Virtha Hussain, who will facilitate our conversation. Before doing that, I'll run through our call logistics, and those are located on slide 2. Upon logging into the webcast, you are automatically set up to listen to our webinar through your computer speakers. This option allows you to sit back and enjoy the webinar. Although we encourage you to listen to the audio through your PC, there is a phone option if needed. Phone lines are limited, but they are there if you need them. If you choose to listen to the audio through your phone, you'll need to download the presentation and follow along manually on your computer. Dial-in information can be found on the player page, and you can access the PDF of the presentation using the materials button. We are offering continuing professional education credits for attending the session. If you're interested in that, you must do two things. First, you must be registered for the session, and second, you must complete the post-session survey. And feel free to visit our website at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. There, you can find the session materials and eventually the archive of this webinar. I'll cover the legal language before turning the call over to our speakers. The opinions expressed in this presentation are intended for informational purposes and are not formal opinions of nor binding on Board of Governors or the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. With all that out of the way, I'm ready to turn the call over to Virtha Hussain at the Federal Reserve Board.
Thank you so much, Jean. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Virtha Hussain, and I am the Managing Counsel for Fair Lending Enforcement at the Federal Reserve. I want to thank you all for tuning in to this year's Interagency Fair Lending webinar. We have a wonderful panel of presenters this year and a lot of good information to share from the NCUA, FHFA, OCC, CFPB, FDIC, Federal Reserve, HUD, and DOJ. We will be having a question and answer session at the end of this webinar. We are all very interested in hearing from you, so please do submit any questions that you might have. Given how packed our webinar is this year, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our first presenter, Matthew Nixon from the NCUA.
Thanks, Virtha. Good afternoon. I'm Matthew Nixon, and I work in the NCUA's Office of Consumer Financial Protection. Recently, our office has identified a small number of credit unions improperly using age as a variable in their credit evaluation systems and processes. Today, I'll discuss the Equal Credit Opportunity Act's general prohibition against discriminating based on an applicant's age, and I'll discuss circumstances where age or age-related information may be considered in a credit transaction. Slide 5, please. ECOA and its implementing regulation, Regulation B, generally prohibit discrimination on a prohibited basis in any aspect of a credit transaction. Slide number 6, please. When we refer to prohibited bases under ECOA, we are specifically referring to the items included on this slide. With limited exceptions, creditors are not allowed to consider these factors in any aspect of a credit transaction. An applicant's age is protected under ECOA. Slide number 7. That said, a creditor may consider age or age-related information under certain circumstances. First, denying credit or refusing to consider an application because an applicant is not of legal age to enter into a binding contract is permissible under ECOA and Regulation B. Additionally, a creditor may favor an elderly applicant, defined as age 62 or older, in any system of evaluating creditworthiness. The creditor may use age as a predictive variable in an empirically derived, demonstrably and statistically sound credit scoring system as long as the age of an elderly applicant is not assigned a negative factor or value. And in a judgmental system of evaluating creditworthiness, age may be considered only for the purpose of determining a pertinent element of creditworthiness. I'll elaborate on the last two bullet points in the next few slides. Slide number 8. As I mentioned earlier, a creditor may use age as a predictive variable in an empirically derived, demonstrably and statistically sound credit scoring system. I've included the definition of an empirically derived, demonstrably and statistically sound credit scoring system on this slide. In short, the credit scoring system must be developed using statistical methods. The system must be initially validated and periodically revalidated. Slide number 9. A judgmental system of evaluating creditworthiness is any system not meeting the definition of an empirically derived, demonstrably and statistically sound credit scoring system. In a judgmental system, a creditor may not deny an application or set the terms and conditions of credit based on age or information related exclusively to age. Age or age-related information may be considered only in evaluating other pertinent elements of creditworthiness that are drawn from the particular facts and circumstances concerning the applicant. Any such evaluation must be made in an individualized case-by-case manner. As an example, a creditor may not deny an application based on an applicant's age, but may consider the adequacy of any security offered when the term of the credit extension exceeds the life expectancy of the applicant. Slide number 10. In recent fair lending examinations, NCUA examiners have identified credit unions, including age, as a variable in judgmental automatic loan approval systems. As I mentioned previously, in a judgmental system of evaluating creditworthiness, creditors may not make credit decisions or set the terms and conditions of credit based on age or information related exclusively to age. Based on NCUA's recent observations, a few credit unions have subjected applicants to a manual review process that is more involved and more time-consuming when applicants do not meet the credit union's automatic loan approval system's age requirements. And some applicants meeting all system requirements for approval except for age are denied credit. We remind credit unions that age is protected under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and creditors may not discriminate on the basis of age in any aspect of a credit transaction unless a regulatory exception applies. That concludes my portion of today's webinar. I will now turn it over to James Wiley from the FHFA.
Thanks, Matt. This is James from the FHFA. FHFA is the regulator for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Home Loan Banks. Let's get started with slide 12 here. First, for all the information I'm providing today, if there's a citation or a link that's not otherwise given, it's available on the FHFA Credit Scores website, which is linked on this slide. The Credit Scores project is a broader project at FHFA. I'm only going to talk about the fair lending aspects of it, but there's also a contact provided on the bottom of this slide should you have questions about the other aspects of the credit scores rule and project at FHFA. So moving to slide 13, I'm going to talk about a process underway to validate and approve new credit scores at Fannie and Freddie. Congress passed a law in 2018 requiring a rule and a competition for validation and approval of new scores. The final rule is done and the process is underway. Fannie and Freddie currently use FICO Classic, which received an initial validation and approval under this new process in November. Moving to slide 14, the rule outlines a four-phase process. The fair lending requirements for the first two phases include a compliance description and a certification as part of an application. The final phase is a detailed assessment of a credit score as used in the enterprise's business processes. That phase includes fair lending testing. The rule established minimum standards related to fair lending and allowed the enterprises to flesh these out and add more requirements as part of a published solicitation. I'm primarily going to be talking about the requirements as described in the solicitation, which was reviewed and approved by FHFA. Moving to slide 15, before I get into more detail, I do want to note that I'm not providing any kind of legal interpretation on the credit scores rule, nor am I discussing any particular credit score or any particular way in which decisions could be made in this process. I'm merely describing some of the elements of the process and then giving examples of how to think about them in practical terms. Each credit score applicant was required to certify to the language on this slide. So why a certification? Well, when you build your own internal model, you have full control over everything inside it. When adopting a third-party model, you don't. The certifications are designed to provide assurance from the model developers on fair lending issues. The language underlined in Romanet 2 talks about proxies. I'll talk about this more later. In Romanet 4, the certification talks about a reasonable, causal, and understandable relationship to credit risk. Some variables may have some correlation with default behavior, but that shouldn't be enough to be included in a model, and this language gets at that idea. In Romanets 5 and 6, the certification requires the applicant to have evaluated the model to support compliance and have policies and processes for fair lending. Each application had to describe these. If we move to slide 16, let's talk more about the proxy language from the certification. We often talk about proxies in fair lending, but it's hard to define one. HUD's charge against Facebook, for example, noted categories for targeted marketing of concern, including one example, quote, hijab fashion. Obviously, that's a proxy for Muslim women. But what about other factors inside a black box model that don't jump off a page like that? How do we know if they are acting as proxies? The details of statistical proxy testing are too much to cover in this presentation. In a nutshell, it involves re-estimating a model in demographically specific samples solely for the purpose of fair lending testing. Including the prohibited factor in the model for scoring is not permitted, of course. This process allows isolating and comparing the effect of various elements of the model on the accuracy and score differences between groups to see if elements may have a high correlation with a protected factor without much influence on risk determination. FHFA does not endorse any particular method of testing. You can find various types of testing described in the economic literature. One popular study noted on the slide is the Federal Reserve's Report to Congress on Credit Scoring from 2007. Given the public concern about fairness in black box models, conducting a proxy test can provide a method for identifying non-obvious factors that may be acting as proxies and provide some assurance that remaining factors are appropriate. If we move to slide 17, once a score has been accepted with a complete application, it gets further fair lending assessment in the final phase. The language from the solicitation describing this is on the slide. It is broadly divided into three categories: credit score value, performance, and access to credit. If we move to slide 18, we'll get into more detail on these. What does credit score value involve? Here we are looking at whether groups have different score distributions and the accuracy of the score for groups. Let's break that down with some examples. In terms of accuracy, you could think about if the score overpredicts or underpredicts risk for certain groups. Some amount of difference is expected because the model cannot contain a protected factor. Also, many factors that contribute to economic stress for a borrower go beyond credit evaluation, and those stressors can differ by group. But if a score significantly overpredicts risk, you might be concerned about an unjustified impact on a group. If it significantly underpredicts, you might be concerned that approved borrowers default at higher rates than expected. On the top right of the slide is an example score distribution taken from the 2007 Federal Reserve study. On the x-axis, we have score values. On the y-axis, we have percentage delinquent accounts. The lines represent different borrower race groups. We can see that in general, the distributions line up well, though there are some differences. One thing we can also see is that the distributions for all groups are generally monotonic, which means that in this case, delinquencies almost always go down as we move to higher scores. We see that for Black borrowers, the topmost line, there is a slightly higher percent of delinquencies at scores of 90 than at 80. We see the same trend for Asian borrowers, the thick, generally bottommost line, at the 70 and 80 scores. Ideally, we would want a higher score to accurately be better for all groups at all points. We might want to investigate these differences further to see whether they are actually significant or maybe unique to a particular sample. You may also want to think about how the score would be used. If the score is only used as a cutoff for minimum approval standards and the cutoff score is 50, we might not be so concerned about these differences because a lower score than 50 is accurately worse for all groups. However, if the score was to be used for risk-based pricing at the 70, 80, and 90 score levels, we might be concerned that some borrower groups would not be accurately assessed in terms of risk at those levels. Moving to slide 19, I'm not going to go into as much detail on the other elements of the final fair lending phase, but I'll cover them briefly. By performance, here we're really talking about whether there are impacts on outcomes in underwriting, credit policies, and pricing based on the score. Access to credit is also included as an element that is sometimes distinct from the concepts discussed earlier. The solicitation also specifically calls out testing in different economic conditions. Performance across the economic cycle is important, as we know that challenging economic conditions often impact minority borrowers the most. Data provided by the credit score applicants will be used in conjunction with the historical enterprise loan data to evaluate these issues during the enterprise business assessment. Hopefully, this presentation has given you some insight into how FHFA thinks about fairness in models and third-party risk management in its regulatory oversight. Thank you. I'm now going to turn it over to Bobby Kennedy from the OCC to talk about Project Reach.
Thank you, James. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's move to slide 21, please. I'm talking about Project REACH today. REACH is the Roundtable for Economic Access and Change. It's an OCC program that has been enacted by the Acting Comptroller. Despite trillions in community reinvestment and philanthropic spending, structural barriers prevent millions from participating fully and fairly in the nation's economy. The OCC recognizes that reducing structural barriers to financial inclusion will result in broader participation in the economy and help millions previously left out of the system achieve their American dreams. Fuller economic participation will improve the lives of those directly affected. Financial empowerment is closely linked to broader socioeconomic outcomes. We anticipate being able to help address the inequities expressed in the recent civil unrest. The Acting Comptroller launched the project to identify structural barriers to full and fair participation in the nation's banking system and the economy, and to identify ways to reduce those barriers and to increase participation in the banking system and the economy. Let's move to slide 22, please. The project brings together leaders from banking, industry, technology, and civil rights. They're charged with identifying specific actionable issues that restrict access to credit and capital for the underserved, and with developing action plans to help address those issues in a limited timeframe. The effort will take on national projects to address broader issues, as well as local projects that can be replicated to address specific needs. Through Project REACH, we hope to eliminate obstacles to accessing credit, affordable housing, and capital. Let's move to slide 23. Over the past 25 years, the wealth gap has increased. Minority homeownership has remained stagnant. Minority unemployment has out, outpaced white non-Hispanic unemployment, and millions continue to be unbanked or underbanked. A financial system that has worked well for most people has left others out. Structural barriers still exist that make it difficult for many to fully and fairly participate in the nation's economy. One structural barrier is credit scoring. Almost 50 million people in the United States have no or incomplete credit scores. 11%, or about 36 million Americans, are credit invisible. That makes credit less accessible and far more expensive. Limited and costly access to credit then limits the capacity to build wealth. Access to affordable housing remains a persistent and growing problem, with homeownership as a primary way that many families build wealth. Lastly, minority-owned banks are critical providers of financial services in their communities, and despite incentives under CRA, they often struggle with competitiveness as a result of limited access to capital, technological obsolescence, and outdated infrastructure. These factors impede their ability to serve their communities as effectively as possible. Let's move to slide 24. One approach to addressing barriers resulting from the lack of or limited credit files is to establish alternative credit scoring methods. These would be methods that, that regulators recognize as safe, sound, and fair, that could assist in underwriting in the absence of traditional credit file data. Obviously, with the statistics I mentioned previously, this could help millions of people. Let's move to slide 25. Approaches to addressing barriers resulting from the lack approaches to addressing barriers resulting from the lack of access to capital, advanced technology, and modern infrastructure include taking advantage of opportunities for more meaningful partnerships to deliver more than temporary financing and help minority-owned banks serve as a vibrant part of the economic landscape. Project objectives include the development of a fund to facilitate investment in minority depositories and provide a higher level of liquidity for those investments. Establishing an executive exchange to provide a forum for introductions and communication across executive management teams at MDIs and non-minority financial institutions to facilitate the connections that make joint efforts feasible. Thirdly, supporting collaborations between MDIs and other banks that provide MDIs with access to technical expertise not otherwise attainable to smaller financial institutions, advanced, efficient, cost-effective lending platforms that enhance the MDI's capacity to serve its community through loans, and lastly, revenue-producing partnerships through lending and servicing of accounts. Let's move to slide 26. Approaches to addressing barriers resulting from the lack of access to affordable housing and homeownership opportunities include creating programs and initiatives to reduce barriers stemming from high housing costs, large down payments, and underwriting based on traditional credit file data. While programs exist that subsidize closing costs and down payments, they often have typically limited availability and relatively high cost to the offering bank. For example, FHA and lower down payment products that are offered typically increase transaction costs and monthly payments, therefore substituting a different barrier debt to income. alternative scoring models face challenges currently, as they're relatively new, untested, and scarce. The project strives to identify and implement elements of and incentives for successful alternative lending platforms and programs for broader use across the industry. Another objective is to convert bank-owned housing inventories into affordable homes through low-cost transfers and renovation loans. Lastly, the project intends to identify and implement elements of and incentives for effective homeownership counseling and financial education programs for broader use across the industry. The objective could include, for example, extending the benefit of savings matching and other equity builder programs to broader populations. Thank you. Now I'm going to turn the presentation over to Christopher Davis in the Office of Fair Lending and Equal Opportunity at the CFPB to discuss CFPB's ECOA request.
Thank you. This is Christopher Davis. I'm with the Office of Fair Lending and Equal Opportunity at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. If we could advance to slide 27, please. Before I get started, my agency does ask that I state the following. This presentation is being made by a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau representative on behalf of the Bureau. It does not constitute legal interpretation, guidance, or advice of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Any opinions or views stated by the presenter are the presenter's own and may not represent the Bureau's views. All right, so with that out of the way, let's get started. The Bureau's mission, as set forth in the Dodd-Frank Act, includes both protecting consumers from unlawful discrimination and fostering innovation. In addition to our supervisory and enforcement work, as well as the Bureau's consumer financial education tools and resources, we are actively seeking input from the public, including the financial industry and consumer advocates and community groups, on how best to create a regulatory environment that prevents credit discrimination and expands access to credit. If we could advance to slide 28, please. On July 28th, the Bureau issued a request for information seeking comments and information to identify opportunities under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and Regulation B to prevent credit discrimination, encourage responsible innovation, promote fair, equitable, and non-discriminatory access to credit, address potential regulatory uncertainty, and develop viable solutions to regulatory compliance challenges. The original deadline for submissions was October 2nd. We did grant an extension, and the comment period actually closed on December 1st. If we could please advance to slide 29. The request for information identifies a variety of important topics under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, or ECOA, and Regulation D, for which the Bureau seeks input from the public. These areas include disparate impact, limited English proficient consumers, special purpose credit programs, affirmative advertising to disadvantaged groups, small business lending, sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination, the scope of federal preemption of state law, public assistance income, artificial intelligence and machine learning, and ECOA adverse action notices. If we could please advance to slide 30. I would like to spend a few minutes just touching on a couple of these topics. First, as mentioned, we did ask for comments about limited English proficient or LEP consumers. Specifically, we asked, should the Bureau provide additional clarity under ECOA and or Regulation B to further encourage creditors to provide assistance, products, and services in languages other than English to consumers with limited English proficiency? If so, in what way? If we could advance to the next slide, please. We also asked about special purpose credit programs. Specifically, we asked, should the Bureau address any potential regulatory uncertainty and facilitate the use of special purpose credit programs? If so, in what way? For example, should the Bureau clarify any of the special purpose credit program provisions in Regulation B? Let's advance to slide 32, please. We also asked for comments on small business. Specifically, we asked, in light of the Bureau's authority under ECOA and Regulation B, in what way might it support efforts to meet the credit needs of small businesses, particularly those that are minority-owned and women-owned? If we could advance to slide 33, please. We also asked about artificial intelligence and machine learning. Specifically, should the Bureau provide more regulatory clarity under ECOA and/or Regulation B to help facilitate innovation in a way that increases access to credit for consumers and communities in the context of artificial intelligence and machine learning without unlawful discrimination? If so, in what way? If we could advance to slide 34. Finally, we asked for comments on adverse action notices. Specifically, should the Bureau modify requirements or guidance concerning notifications of action taken, including adverse action notices, under ECOA and/or Regulation B, to better empower consumers to make more informed financial decisions and/or to provide additional clarity when credit underwriting decisions are based in part on models that use artificial intelligence and machine learning? If so, in what way? We also asked, should the Bureau provide any additional guidance under ECOA and/or Regulation B related to when adverse action has been taken by a creditor, requiring a notification that includes a statement of specific reasons for the adverse action? If so, in what way? If we could please go to slide 35. Because I did mention the request for comment on adverse action notices, I did also just want to let folks on this call know that in October, we held a tech sprint, which was designed for participating teams to come up with ways to improve adverse action credit disclosures so that consumers and financial institutions can learn more from the data and increase people's access to credit in the future. And with that, I will turn it over to David Evans from the FDIC. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. We're on slide 36 now. The Office I'm in is responsible for handling all the significant fair lending matters that our examiners identified during our consumer compliance examinations. I'll note that the FDIC supervises over 3,000 banks, and the vast majority are rated 1 or 2 for consumer compliance. This means that nearly all of them control risk and prevent consumer harm. Nonetheless, our examiners do periodically identify issues that result in fair lending violations. Let's move to slide 37. A strong compliance management system helps ensure consumers are treated fairly and that the institution is complying with federal consumer protection laws and regulations, including all of those relating to fair lending. Written policies and procedures are an important component of any fair lending program. This would include information that lending staff reference when determining whether borrowers are creditworthy. Policies and procedures may also include pricing criteria, how the banks set the consumer's loan rate after the credit decision is made. As part of the fair lending review, our examiners will carefully read through all of the bank's written credit policies and procedures. So as part of the compliance program, it's important that banks take steps to ensure that policies and procedures help manage fair lending risk and that they are not the source of such risk. Slide 38, please. When examiners review lending policies, they'll pay close attention to any indication that a prohibited basis is considered. Matt Nixon touched on this a little bit in his presentation, but to reiterate, all the prohibited bases are described in the two primary laws covering fair lending, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, or what I'll call ECOA, and the Fair Housing Act, the FHA. Both of these laws prohibit discrimination based on race, color, religion, national origin, and sex. ECOA also prohibits discrimination based on marital status, age, an applicant's receipt of income from a public assistance program, and an applicant's good faith exercise of any rights under the Consumer Credit Protection Act. The FHA prohibits discrimination based on familial status and disability. I'll now talk about three specific discrimination issues our examiners identified over the last year or so. Each of these issues have a common thread. fair lending matters arising from written policies. Essentially, our examiners identified overt discrimination concerns after reviewing the policies in place at the bank or with a third party used by the bank. Slide 39, please. So for the first case, I'll talk about the examiners identified a fair lending concern in how a bank underwrote commercial loans. In general, the issue arose because the bank's underwriting process involved the use of a screening system to identify and deny loan applications from nonprofit organizations. The bank had an internal policy to not extend credit to nonprofits. However, the process ultimately resulted in applications being denied on the prohibited basis of religion. This is because to identify applications from nonprofits, the bank created a keyword list of terms that were screened against an applicant's business name during the initial fraud check of the underwriting process. The fair lending issue came about because the keywords on this list only included religious terms, terms such as God, mosque, church. The impact of this written policy was to exclude credit applicants on the prohibited basis of religion. Applications from non-religious organizations were being approved, while those from religious organizations were being denied. A takeaway here is that a careful review of policies, including those that apply to commercial credit, should ensure that prohibited basis terms, such as religion, are not used to identify and treat applicants differently. It's important to note here, too, that some people think fair lending laws apply to only consumer loans. However, with only limited exceptions, commercial loans are also covered by ECOA. Let's look at another case, slide 40. So we talked about underwriting policies, but what about pricing policies? In this example, examiners identified a policy that called for different pricing methods for married joint applicants as compared to unmarried joint applicants. In general, if applicants were married, the bank's policy stated that the loan officer should use the highest credit score of the two applicants to price the loan. If they were unmarried, loan officers would use the main applicant's credit score. The bank considered the main applicant to be the person listed first on the credit application. The bank had a tiered scoring system which called for higher loan rates for applicants with lower scores. Otherwise, the policy allowed borrowers with a higher credit scores to be priced with a lower rate. So, since married applicants were being priced using the highest credit score and unmarried applicants using the main applicant's credit score, the effect of this policy was to price applicants differently on the prohibited basis of marital status. The takeaway here is that a close review of the written policy in use by the bank revealed a difference in treatment, spelled out in writing, that the bank had one pricing standard for married applicants and another for non-married applicants. It's important to review both the underwriting policies and the pricing policies to ensure there are no prohibitive bases considered. Let's look at the third case, slide 41, please. So what if a third party is involved in the credit decision process? In one case, the bank was originating unsecured loans through these third-party partners. In general, the bank's relationship with these third parties worked two ways. First, a third party operated a website where applicants could fill in information and apply for credit directly on that site. The second relationship involved a third party buying leads from an online lead generator. What this means is that if a consumer searched the internet to find a lender, they may get directed to a lead generator, a company that takes information from the prospective applicant and then sends that information to the lenders that buy the leads. The applicant's information, the lead, was purchased by a third party hired by the bank. Since it was using the bank's underwriting criteria, the third party was only buying leads that would result in a loan that the bank would originate. The fair lending issue arose when examiners reviewed the underwriting criteria and filtering methods being used by the third parties. Examiners discovered that these criteria included the prohibited bases of age and the receipt of public assistance income. So how was age being considered? Well, for both the website and the leads, If the applicant was under 30, the bank would deny the application. Same with the leads. Again, if the applicant was under 30, the third party would not purchase the lead. Remember, the age is a prohibited basis under the law. Next, for public assistance income, the applicants who applied on the website had to select their source of income from a drop-down menu. The menu included options for the source of income, such as employment, Social Security, pension. If the applicant chose any option other than employment from the drop-down, the application was denied. Same with the leads. If anything other than employment was selected, the lead would not be purchased. Therefore, the bank was declining applicants who received public assistance income. For example, if the consumer selected Social Security from the menu, the application would be denied. Social Security is a source of public assistance income, which is a prohibited basis under the law. In addition to reviewing written policies, it's also important to review any filters or criteria that are used for online leads or website applications. And if these policies are implemented in connection with a third party, remember, the bank is ultimately responsible for managing the risks that arise through third-party relationships and activities. Banks should monitor the actions of the third party to the same extent as if the activity were handled within the bank itself. So that brings us to the list of takeaways here. Let's go to slide 42, please. As I mentioned at the beginning, the discrimination issues in all three of these cases were simply identified by examiners who carefully reviewed the bank's written policies. They read through the documentation that showed what the banks consider when both underwriting and pricing credit. A similar review performed by the bank's compliance department can help identify fair lending risk in written policies and procedures, including all those used by the third parties. Such a review could extend to the language used in online applications or any screening filters. Slide 43, please. On this slide, I've listed some resources available to you. The first is a link to the FDIC's Fair Lending Resources page. This contains a collection of supervisory and regulatory information all relating to fair lending compliance. The next is a link to the FDIC's technical resource videos. These include several topics relating to fair lending compliance in particular. There's also a link to the FDIC's Fair Lending Scope and Conclusions memo. This is the template our FDIC examiners use to document the fair lending review. Last, since we talked about third-party risk, I provided the link to a financial institution letter that discusses details on this topic. All right, so this concludes my part of the presentation. I'm now going to turn it over to Katrina Blodgett. She is a senior counsel with the Federal Reserve Board. Katrina will discuss managing fair lending risks and underwriting and pricing exceptions.
Thank you, David. And as Jean mentioned at the beginning, the opinions expressed in this presentation are for information purposes only and are not formal opinions of or binding on the Federal Reserve. Slide 45, please. Since our time is short today, I'm going to move quickly through my first several slides, but they do contain useful information, and I encourage you to look back at them. My focus today will be on fair lending risks in mortgage underwriting and pricing exceptions. Slide 46, please. As you can see, the Federal Reserve supervises over 800 state member banks with shared jurisdiction with the CFPB for some banks. Slide 47, please. Largely speaking, an exception is when an underwriting or mortgage officer, or MLO, has discretion to override underwriting standards, change the offered note rate from a rate sheet or loan origination system, or LOS, or reduce or waive fees. Keep in mind that for fair lending purposes, an exception may be different than what is considered an exception from a safety and soundness perspective. In thinking about exceptions in mortgage underwriting and pricing, it's useful to think about the two main types of mortgage products, secondary market mortgage loans and portfolio mortgage loans. While exceptions may be made in both types of products, they may look a little different. For example, in secondary market lending, the lender may add overlays to existing underwriting and pricing standards, while in a portfolio product, the lender determines the underwriting and pricing criteria. However, the key issue for any product is discretion. When discretion is permitted to make exceptions to underwriting or pricing decisions, fair lending risk can arise. The initial decision may be automated, for example, through the use of software or a rate sheet. But for exception tracking and monitoring, the question is whether discretion is allowed after that initial decision is returned. Slide 48, please. Pricing exceptions are the most common type of exception, so let's start there. The first type of pricing exception that we'll consider is rate exception. So I'm going to start with the concept of par price, which we use to refer to the standard interest rate that's calculated by an LOS or rate sheet. And that's based on the borrower's credit characteristics and the desired loan product. In a nutshell, we would consider par price to be the lowest rate that the borrower qualifies for, given the loan product and borrower preferences. So to illustrate how par can vary based on the product, consider that borrowers with identical credit profiles and loan amounts will have different rates if one borrower is seeking a no closing cost loan. The higher rate for that no closing cost loan wouldn't be considered an exception because it's part of the product and the institution is using the par price for that product. In that case, the institution would likely issue a lender credit to cover the closing costs, and that would be compensated by a higher rate. Another important point on pricing exceptions are instances where an institution permits an MLO to select a price that's either above or below par without needing authorization from management, as long as the price stays within a specified range of par. The institution may not consider pricing within this range to be an exception to its stated policies, but for fair lending monitoring purposes, these deviations up or down would be considered exceptions. When it comes to pricing exceptions, we look for policies and procedures that specify when an exception can be made and for such exceptions to be recorded and monitored for fair lending risk. A common example of a rate exception is to meet a competing offer. Competing offers are a large source of pricing and fee exceptions. It's important that policies and procedures specify how such a competing offer should be documented and recorded in the loan file, in addition to recording and monitoring the exception. A best practice would be to track deviations from par, either above or below, and a text field to explain why an exception is made. This can be done in the LOS or on a separate spreadsheet. Slide 49, please. So here's some common reasons that institutions permit exceptions for pricing. When setting policies and procedures, it's important to be clear about the circumstances that will permit pricing exceptions. For example, competition is a common reason for pricing exceptions, and here the policy specifies how such a competing offer should be documented and that it should be recorded in the loan file. Going back to an earlier point, a pricing exception would be considered any price that is above or below the note rate dictated by the par price. And in some instances, MLOs may be able to go above or below par within a certain range without needing to meet an exception policy or obtain approval. And as I said before, these departures would still be exceptions for purposes of fair lending tracking and analysis. Another thing to keep in mind is that reductions in rates or fees that are automatically available to all borrowers, such as a reduction in rate for using auto debiting for payment, are not considered exceptions. However, if the reduction requires additional qualification or is not automatically extended to all qualified customers, it may be an exception. Slide 50, please. In addition to rate exceptions, fee exceptions may also be offered. Particularly for lender fees, the institution may permit them to be waived or reduced. In this example, for a banking relationship. In addition to having a clear written policy, A best practice would be to track expected fees and collected fees, along with a text explanation of why an exception was made. Slide 51, please. Pricing exceptions are more common, but underwriting exceptions still occur. In the secondary market, investors set the underwriting standards, but exceptions are still possible. First, where the lender has made an overlay to those standards, exceptions can be made to the overlay criteria and still result in a loan that is sellable on the secondary market. Another area where exceptions might arise is where the automated underwriting system returns a decision of refer eligible, which may require additional manual steps before the loan can be approved. Depending on their level of authority within the institution, underwriters may be allowed to perform manual underwriting. The AUS recommendation is now a HMDA field. However, as supervisors, even before it was a HMDA field, we were able to obtain and review the AUS recommendation field, and we'll continue to look at that field. A key question is whether there's a policy for when an applicant will be reviewed for manual underwriting, and whether there is discretion in who is reviewed manually. For instance, some institutions review every denial to determine if the applicant can be manually underwritten. So every denied applicant has the opportunity to obtain an exception. Fair lending risk occurs when the opportunity for an exception isn't evenly distributed. Slide 52, please. A low-side underwriting exception occurs when the applicant doesn't meet the underwriting criteria designated by the lender or investor. For example, if the applicant's credit score is below the cutoff. In our example, the institution permits an exception where the applicant has a 5-year banking relationship with the bank and a positive payment history on a prior loan with the bank. Here, the bank's policy specifies the length of the banking relationship that would allow manual underwrite of the credit score cutoff. As examiners, we would consider whether the rules are clear or if exceptions can be applied subjectively. We would also want to see that the institution records exceptions and monitors them for fair lending risk. Slide 53, please. A high side override would occur where the applicant meets the underwriting criteria but is ultimately denied. High side overrides are less common than low side overrides. In this example, the applicant meets the underwriting criteria but has a history of late payments on a previous credit product with the bank. The bank has a policy that applicants with a negative credit history with the bank may not be approved for a loan, and the policy spells out what type of negative history and its recency would allow a high side underwriting exception. Again, we would consider whether the rules are clear or if exceptions can be applied subjectively. Slide 54, please. So to manage these fair lending risks related to exceptions, there are three key pieces to a strong exceptions compliance program. First, the institution can establish clear policies identifying the reasons exceptions are permitted and the amount of exception that may be granted. In addition, as discussed, the policy can identify who will be considered for an exception, such as a policy to review every denied loan. The policy should also establish the method for granting exceptions, such as the need for management chain approval. Remember, even where the institution may not require an MLO to get authorization to go above or below par within a certain range, this would still be an exception for fair lending purposes. A second key piece of a strong compliance program is exception tracking. As discussed in our 2017 presentation on this webinar, which is linked on the resource slide, this may be done manually or in the LOS. A best practice is to include the reason for the exception, such as an exception code, as well as the amount of the exception. For example, for a rate exception, the institution might track both the par note rate and the actual note rate. And for fees, the institution might track the original fee versus the collected fee. Another piece of information that might be collected is who was involved in granting the exception, such as the identity of the MLO. Finally, this exception tracking can be used to monitor for fair lending risk. look for patterns of different outcomes by prohibited basis groups in the incidence of exceptions, as well as the amount of pricing exceptions. For example, you could look at the average difference between expected and collected fees by prohibited basis groups. Consider the magnitude of exceptions. It may be that the number of exceptions is similar across groups, but that the amount of the exception varies. Another thing to consider in monitoring is to look at, is to look at the overall incidence of exceptions. If exceptions are high, the underwriting or pricing criteria may need to be revised so that the exception is integrated into the policy rather than an exception to it. Slide 55, please. As mentioned, here is a link to our 2017 presentation on exception tracking, as well as some additional general compliance resources. Thank you for your attention. And now I'll turn it over to Roseanne Aviles at HUD for her presentation on HUD's disparate impact rule.
Good afternoon. Today I'll be discussing HUD's disparate impact rule published on September 24, 2020, which was set to go into effect on October 26, 2020. Slide 57, please. I'll briefly walk through the rule and discuss notable differences from the proposed rule or HUD's 2013 disparate impact rule. And finally, I'll wrap up at the end by briefly discussing the current injunction prohibiting implementation and enforcement of HUD's 2020 disparate impact rule. Slide 58, please. Under the final rule, 24 CFR 100.500 now begins with a general statement that liability may be established under the Fair Housing Act based on a specific policy or practice's discriminatory effect on members of a protected class, even if the specific practice was not motivated by discriminatory intent. This provision changes from the language of the 2013 disparate impact rule in several notable respects, but I'll highlight one. The 2020 final rule removes the 2013 disparate impact rule language, clarifying that a practice has a discriminatory effect where it perpetuates segregated housing patterns because of a protected characteristic. That said, HUD clarified in the final rule's preamble that removal of the perpetuation of segregation language was part of HUD's streamlining effort, and the removal did not modify any obligation under the Fair Housing Act and was not meant to imply that perpetuation of segregation claims could never be harm prohibited by the disparate impact rule. Slide 59, please. After the general paragraph on liability in the final rule, 24 CFR 100.500 paragraph B, the final rule sets out five elements a plaintiff must plead to state a plausible disparate impact claim. The first element requires plaintiffs to sufficiently plead facts that the challenged policy or practice is arbitrary, artificial, and unnecessary to achieve a valid interest or legitimate objective, such as a practical business, profit, policy consideration, or requirement of law. The second element requires plaintiffs to sufficiently plead facts that the challenged policy or practice has a disproportionately adverse effect on members of a protected class. The third element requires plaintiffs to sufficiently plead facts that there is a robust causal link between the challenged policy or practice and the adverse effect on members of a protected class, meaning that the specific policy or practice is the direct cause of the discriminatory effect. The fourth element requires plaintiffs to sufficiently plead facts that the alleged disparity caused by the policy or practice is significant. And the fifth element requires plaintiffs to sufficiently plead facts that there is a direct relation between the injury asserted and the injurious conduct alleged. Slide 60, please. In the final rules, 24 CFR 100.500C, HUD sets forth a three-step burden-shifting framework to establish that a policy or practice has a discriminatory effect. Under step one, a plaintiff must prove by the preponderance of the evidence each of the elements in paragraphs B2 through 5 that I just discussed. And that would be that the policy or practice has a disproportionately adverse effect, that there's a robust causal link, that the disparity is significant, and that there's a direct relation between the injury asserted and the injurious conduct alleged. Under step two, a defendant may rebut a plaintiff's allegation that the challenged policy or practice is arbitrary, artificial, and unnecessary by producing evidence showing that the challenged policy or practice advances a valid interest and is therefore not arbitrary, artificial, and unnecessary. And under the third step, if a defendant rebuts a plaintiff's allegation, the plaintiff must prove by the preponderance of the evidence either that the interests advanced by the defendant are not valid or that a less discriminatory policy or practice exists that would serve the defendant's identified interests in an equally effective manner without imposing materially greater costs on or creating other material burdens for the defendant. Slide 61, please. In the final rules, 24 CFR 100.500D, HUD sets forth defenses that can be raised both at the pleading stage and after. In subparagraph D1, HUD clarifies that at the pleading stage, the defendant may establish that a plaintiff has failed to sufficiently plead facts to support an element of a prima facie case by showing that the defendant's policy or practice was reasonably necessary to comply with a third-party requirement, such as federal, state, or local law, binding or controlling court, arbitral, administrative order, or opinion, or binding or controlling regulatory, administrative, or government guidance or requirement. Slide 62, please. In subparagraph D2, HUD clarifies that after the pleading stage, a defendant can establish that the plaintiff failed to meet the burden of proof through three different means. First, the defendant can raise what's been called the outcome prediction defense. The final rule provides that a defendant can raise this defense by showing that a policy or practice is intended to predict an occurrence of an outcome, the prediction represents a valid interest, and the outcome predicted by the policy or practice does not or would not have a disparate impact on protected classes compared to similarly situated individuals not part of the protected class. The rule goes on to clarify that this would not be an adequate defense if the plaintiff demonstrates that an alternative, less discriminatory policy or practice would result in the same outcome of a policy or practice without imposing materially greater costs on or creating other material burdens for the defendant. The second way a defendant can establish that the plaintiff failed to meet the burden of proof is by demonstrating that the plaintiff has failed to establish that a policy or practice has a discriminatory effect. Third and finally, the defendant can raise the third-party defense, specifically that the defendant's policy or practice is reasonably necessary to comply with a third-party requirement, such as a federal, state, or local law, binding or controlling court, arbitral, administrative order, or opinion, or binding or controlling regulatory, administrative, or government guidance or requirement. Slide 63, please. The final rule retains a provision added in the proposed rule providing that state laws regulating insurance will supersede the Fair Housing Act in a disparate impact case if the application of the Fair Housing Act in that case would invalidate, impair, or supersede state law regulating insurance. Slide 64. The final rule includes a provision pertaining to remedies available in disparate impact cases. Specifically, in cases where liability is based solely on a disparate impact theory, the final rule instructs that remedies should be concentrated on eliminating or reforming the discriminatory practice so as to eliminate disparities between persons in a particular protected class and other persons. In addition, the final rule adds provisions restricting HUD itself and the types of damages HUD will seek where HUD is the party bringing a disparate impact case. Slide 65. The final rule adds a severability provision. Specifically, it provides that the disparate impact framework of the burdens and defenses are considered to be severable, so invalidation of one provision doesn't necessarily invalidate the others. Slide 66, the 2020 rule adds a data collection paragraph that provides that neither the disparate impact standard nor anything in HUD's Fair Housing Regulations in Part 100 requires or encourages a collection of data with respect to protected classes. This represents a small change from the proposed rule. In the proposed rule, HUD had additionally specified that the absence of a party's data collection would not result in any adverse inference against that party. In the preamble to the final rule, HUD acknowledged that there may be cases where collecting data may be required by laws outside HUD's disparate impact rule, and the sentence regarding adverse inferences created uncertainty and confusion, so it was omitted. Slide 67, please. Advocacy organizations from across the country have challenged HUD's 2020 disparate impact rule. For example, there are cases pending in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, the District of Connecticut, and the District of Massachusetts. On October 25th, 2020, moving on to slide 68, the day before the final rule was supposed to take effect, a judge in the District of Massachusetts stayed implementation of HUD's 2020 disparate impact rule in its entirety, pending entry of a final judgment on plaintiff's APA claims in that case. The judge also preliminarily enjoined HUD from implementing or enforcing the final rule in any manner or in any respect, and ordered HUD to preserve the status quo pursuant to the regulations in effect as of October 25, 2020, which are the regulations that implemented HUD's 2013 disparate impact rule. So based on that order, the disparate impact rule currently in effect is HUD's 2013 disparate impact rule. That concludes my presentation, and I'll be handing it over now to Carrie Panuco from the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division.
Thanks so much, Roseanne. Good afternoon. Thanks to the Federal Reserve for hosting us and giving us the opportunity to present on auto lending, a topic of continuing importance in fair lending enforcement. Today, I'll be discussing an enforcement action brought by the Department of Justice against a used car dealership, Guaranteed Auto Sales, that was based on testing evidence. Our complaint alleged that the dealership discriminated on the basis of race. The defendant here a small used car dealership, and I know most of our audience today are sophisticated lenders with a very different business model from the defendant. I hope this case will be interesting to lenders listening today because it involves the department's fair lending testing and because allegations of the complaint include acts of discouragement under ECOA. Slide 70, please. Here you see Guaranteed Auto Sales, a small used car dealership located in Glen Burnie, Maryland, a suburb of Baltimore. The dealership arranged financing for cars in two ways. First, the dealership offered buy here, pay here financing with terms of sales and financing determined by the dealership's general manager. And second, at the time of the United States complaint, the dealership partnered with a third-party financing company, Credit Acceptance Corporation, to offer financing to customers unable to secure credit otherwise. The manager determined threshold criteria that borrowers had to meet before he initiated an application to Credit Acceptance, including the down payment amount. Other terms of financing, such as interest rate, were determined directly by Credit Acceptance. For both buy here, pay here and Credit Acceptance financing, the manager was allowed to decide whether to grant credit and on what terms with no written guidance and no objective criteria. Last fall, the United States filed a complaint in the District of Maryland alleging violations of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act against Guaranteed Auto Sales, its owner, and its manager. Slide 71, please. The ECOA violations asserted in the United States complaint are based on testing evidence developed by the Civil Rights Division's in-house fair housing testing program. The testing program was established in 1991 and began testing in 1992, and coordinates testing across the United States. Testing involves individuals who pose as consumers in search of goods, such as housing, financing, or public accommodations, which includes hotel reservations or service at a restaurant or bar, for the purpose of collecting evidence to determine whether the provider is complying with civil rights laws. To date, the Fair Housing Testing Program has developed over 110 cases, resulting in over $13 million in total relief. In this case, the testers were individuals who posed as prospective car purchasers to gather information about possible discriminatory practices at Guaranteed Auto Sales. Here, the test compared the experiences of black male testers with white male testers. Slide 72, please. Testers with similar credit characteristics contacted the dealership between September 2017 and April 2018. For example, both white and black testers had similar down payment amounts, with black testers having slightly more money available. Black testers had a down payment of $1,200 and white testers had $1,100. Slide 73, please. The test revealed four significant differences in the financing offered to black and white testers. These differences form the basis of the United States claim that defendants discriminated against applicants on the basis of race by offering more favorable terms to white testers than to black testers with similar credit characteristics. First, white testers were offered the option to fund their down payments in two installments, by paying what they had available that day and paying the remaining balance within 14 or 30 days. None of the black testers were offered that option, even though they had $100 more than white testers available for the down payment. Second, in the tests involving credit acceptance financing, all of the black testers were told that they needed a higher down payment than the white testers were told for the same car, generally $2,000 instead of $1,500. Third, in the test involving buy here, pay here financing, the black tester was quoted biweekly payments that were higher than the white tester was quoted for the same car, $150 instead of $125 every 2 weeks. And finally, the test revealed evidence of other acts that discouraged black testers. Regulation B prohibits a creditor from making a statement to a prospective applicant that would discourage a person from making an application. And ECOA specifically envisions enforcement actions brought by the Attorney General against creditors who have engaged in a pattern or practice of discouraging or denying applications for credit. Our complaint alleges that defendants told one black tester that he had to purchase a $1,700 warranty to obtain credit acceptance financing when no white tester was given this information. In another example, defendants told a black tester that it would not be worth a credit inquiry to see if credit acceptance would accept a $1,200 down payment, since the manager was 90% certain the loan would not be approved unless the down payment was $2,000. But a white tester was told that defendants could try a down payment of $1,100 on the same car and increase it to $1,500 only if it was necessary to secure credit acceptance financing. Slide 74, please. As is our usual practice, we offer defendants an opportunity to resolve our allegations pre-suit and continue to discuss settlement even after filing this case. Our complaint sought declaratory and injunctive relief and monetary damages for any aggrieved persons who we might identify. On July 2nd, we filed a consent order to resolve the United States claims. The settlement requires defendants to develop written policies to ensure that all prospective customers receive consistent information and non-discriminatory financing options. Effective policies and compliance management systems are almost always a part of our fair lending settlements. Weak policies or ineffective monitoring are viewed as red flags in our investigations. The consent order also requires defendants to attend training on the requirements of ECOA and engage in record keeping and reporting to the United States. Our compliance oversight will last for 3 years. The settlement does not include the payment of any money by the defendants. Financing records maintained by the dealership did not allow us to assess whether there were differences in financing based on race for individual credit applicants and borrowers. Slide 75, please. This case reveals the continued importance of testing in ferreting out discrimination that is often invisible to individuals, including in the world of auto lending. It also sends a clear message that lenders must never make credit decisions based on race. This settlement ensures defendants will comply with ECOA moving forward, but more broadly, it outlines for lenders of all sizes what the United States may look to in determining compliance with ECOA and what it expects in terms of fair credit policies and monitoring. Slide 76, please. For more information about this case, our other cases, and the department's fair lending enforcement in general, please visit our website, www.usdoj.gov/fairhousing. You can also see our annual ECOA reports to Congress by visiting www.justice.gov/CRT/fair-lending-program-0. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Carrie. This is Fareeha Hussain from the Federal Reserve. I wanted to thank all of the presenters, and I'm going to be moderating the question and answer session of the webinar. We have about 15 minutes, and so let me just get started. The first question is for the FHFA. James, does FHFA include fair lending standards in any of its other rules for its regulated entities?
Thank you. Yes. Yes, we do. So we're a relatively young office at FHFA. 2018 is when we were stood up, and that's the first time FHFA has had a dedicated fair lending office. But we do include fair lending standards and other FHFA processes. There's a recent rule we issued that would be a process for the approval of new products at the enterprises, sort of outside of conservatorship, and there's a fair lending submission that is included in that rule and required as part of that. We also recently issued a rule on capital standards for the enterprises, and fair lending analysis was part of the development of those capital standards to ensure that those capital standards complied with fair lending principles. Thank you.
Great, thanks so much. Our next question is for HUD. Suzanne, how is HUD handling investigations involving a disparate impact theory of liability?
HUD always investigates claims under all potential theories of liability. From our agency's perspective, the evidence we seek to investigate a complaint would not really change.
Great, thank you so much. The next question is for the Department of Justice. Carrie, how does DOJ identify targets for investigation?
Sure. Under ECOA, the Attorney General has a broad and independent authority to investigate and bring enforcement actions that involve a pattern or practice of discrimination in violation of the statute. The department may initiate an investigation based on complaints from individuals or organizations, or on the basis of publicly available information or data, including HMDA data. The department also initiates investigations based on referrals from other regulatory agencies. We've highlighted testing today, and in any investigation, the department may determine that testing evidence may be a helpful tool to determine the existence of discrimination. Thanks.
Thanks, Carrie. Okay, the next question is for the Federal Reserve. Katrina, my policy for locking rates allows a loan officer to go down 0.25%. From the rate sheet before I track this as an exception. Is this a concern?
That's a great question, and it helps to illustrate the difference between what may be considered an exception in bank policy and what could be an exception that could pose fair lending risk. So in order to manage fair lending risk, any departure from the rate sheet can be tracked and monitored to look for disparities in rate on a prohibited basis. That doesn't necessarily mean that the bank needs to change its policy regarding what it considers an exception that would require management approval. That said, if monitoring shows that these departures are distributed unevenly on a prohibited basis, the bank may want to take a look at the policy and determine how to address that fair lending risk.
Thank you, Katrina. We have a question for the FDIC. David, in terms of third-party risk, what if the bank was completely unaware of what the third party was doing? Would the bank still be liable for fair lending violations?
Yes. So we recognize that financial institutions will often rely on the third parties to perform a wide variety of services and other activities. That said, an institution's board, its senior management, they're ultimately responsible for managing all of the activities conducted through the third-party relationship. So if a bank is offering credit products using a third party, the institution in that case is the creditor, and it remains responsible for compliance with all the applicable laws, including everything relating to fair lending. So it would generally be prudent for an institution to identify and just control the risks arising from third-party relationships, to the same extent as if the activity was handled by the bank itself. And as I noted in my slide deck, I provided a link to the FDIC's financial institution letter 44-2008. So that's good information for guidance on managing third-party risk.
Thanks so much, David. Okay, we have another question on disparate impact. This one is for the CFPB. Christopher, what is the Bureau currently doing on disparate impact?
Sure. So the Bureau continues to evaluate the use of disparate impact under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act on a case-by-case basis based on the specific facts and circumstances of each matter. As I mentioned, in July, the Bureau also issued a request for information regarding RCOA, seeking public input on how best to create a regulatory environment that expands access to credit and ensures that all consumers and communities are protected from discrimination in all aspects of the credit transaction. Regarding disparate impact in particular, the request for information asked, should the Bureau provide additional clarity regarding its approach to disparate impact analysis under ECOA and or Regulation B? If so, in what way? The information that was provided will help the Bureau continue to explore ways to address regulatory compliance challenges while fulfilling the Bureau's core mission to prevent unlawful discrimination and foster innovation. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Christopher. We have a question for the NCUA. Matthew, you mentioned in a judgmental system of evaluating creditworthiness, age-related information may be considered only in evaluating other pertinent elements of creditworthiness. Can you explain what you mean by pertinent elements of creditworthiness?
Yes, thank you. I believe Regulation B defines pertinent element of creditworthiness to mean any information about an applicant a creditor considers and that has a demonstrable relationship to a determination of creditworthiness. And I realize that that definition alone may not clear things up, especially if we're talking about it relative to age or age-related information. So as an example, let's consider young adults. Young adults generally go through the process of establishing credit. And until a track record of successfully paying creditors is established, applicants may be denied credit, they may be granted credit on less than favorable terms, or they may be required to provide a cosigner. So length of credit history can be considered a pertinent element of creditworthiness. Absence of credit history therefore is correlated with age, but the pertinent element of creditworthiness is not that a person is young, it's the lack of credit history and inability to demonstrate reduced credit risk. I guess I would also say that pertinent element of creditworthiness considerations generally should be supported by institution or industry data. So for example, if the data supports 24 months or 36 months, et cetera, as an appropriate length of time for an applicant to demonstrate a history of payment, then the creditor should not arbitrarily use a longer period in its evaluation process. Thank you.
Thanks for that answer. We have a question for the OCC. Bobby, last week, the acting comptroller of the currency issued a statement about the Project Reach MDI pledge. Could you please discuss that statement?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The acting comptroller is encouraging all large and mid-sized banks to consider signing the Project Reach MDI pledge, which is a pledge to develop meaningful partnerships with MDIs. It's intended to draw attention to the significant obstacles that currently face those institutions. The pledge consists of commitments to invest in an MDI, provide technical assistance, identify business opportunities targeted to expand the MDI's reach and impact within its own communities, support executive development, and commit resources to the MDI's operations and customers. Some of the bank members of Project REIT have already signed the pledge and have opined that the project will help provide vital equity capital and other resources that MDIs need. It'll also leverage large bank expertise, capabilities, and scale, local market expertise, with local market expertise, community knowledge, and long-established relationships to serve communities more effectively. provides full access to banking and economic opportunity to those who need it most. And lastly, increased capacity for MDI in underserved communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby. One more question for DOJ. Carrie, can you tell us how many tests the Department of Justice conducts before determining whether a violation of law has occurred?
Sure. So as you can tell from the complaint in Guaranteed Auto Sales, the department conducted more than one test to develop allegations of discrimination with respect to both buy here, pay here, and third-party financing. In general, there isn't a hard and fast rule that would dictate the number of tests that the department must complete to bring a case and to prove that ECOA violations have occurred. Really, each investigation presents a different set of facts that may result in a different testing strategy. In order for the department to initiate an enforcement action, the evidence must always demonstrate a pattern or practice of discrimination. Thanks.
Thanks, Carrie. Okay, one more question for FHFA. James, does FHFA examine its regulated entities for fair lending?
Thank you for that question. So yes, as I mentioned, you know, we're a fairly young fair lending program, but we do examine our regulated entities for fair lending. Our exam program is still developing, and you know, our exams obviously look a little bit different given the nature of our entities compared to primary lenders.
Great, thanks. I'm going to see if I can squeeze a few more questions in, and thank you to the audience for submitting so many questions. One question for the CFPB. Christopher, can you tell us more about tech sprints? What can you share about these efforts?
Sure. So in June, we announced our first ever tech sprints to reduce regulatory burden and improve consumer understanding of financial services. The Bureau's tech sprints program brings together regulators, technologists, software providers, consumer groups, and financial institutions to develop technological solutions to shared compliance challenges. As I previously mentioned, participants in our October 5th through 9th 2020 tech sprint were asked to develop and test innovative approaches to electronic delivery of adverse action notices required under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Many federal consumer financial laws were written in a paper-based age. The use of digital technology and alternative delivery mechanisms, for example, online and mobile, for disclosure content may enable greater consumer engagement and understanding. Participants in this tech sprint designed innovative electronic methods for informing consumers about adverse credit actions, including from the use of algorithms. One last point, next spring, the March 22nd through 26th, 2021 tech sprint will focus on innovative HMDA data submission, processing, and publication through new HMDA platform tools and technologies. Tech sprint participants may help develop new tools to address compliance challenges and improve the filing process, and may work to further develop the HMDA platform's application programming interfaces in order to increase efficiency and lower costs. Thanks.
Thanks, Christopher. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question to the FDIC. David, the FDIC described all of the prohibited bases, including age. Aren't there certain circumstances when a creditor could consider age?
Yes, that is right. So as we discussed, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act prohibits the creditor from taking into account an applicant's age, and that's provided that the applicant actually has the capacity to enter into a binding contract. But there is one exception. In any system, when they evaluate creditworthiness, if the creditor actually considers the age of an elderly applicant, that is, when the applicant is 62 years or older, they can do that to favor the applicant in extending credit. In addition, a credit program that offers more flexible credit terms to applicants that are age 62 or older, that's also permissible. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, David. I see that we are at time, so we've reached the end of this year's Interagency Fair Lending webinar. Before I turn it over to Jean to close us out, I just wanted to thank all of the presenters for their excellent presentations, I also want to thank Western Miller, counsel on the Fair Lending Enforcement Team at the Federal Reserve, for organizing this year's webinar, and to also thank Jean Wark from the Center for Learning Innovation at the St. Louis Federal Reserve and Jason Liu from the San Francisco Federal Reserve for all of their help with this webinar. With that, Jean, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Bertha. We'll be sending an email with a link to our survey. Please take just a moment to fill that out. We read every response and strive to make our sessions better based upon your feedback. I'd also like to extend our thank yous to the Outlook Live team. And as one more quick reminder, remember to check our website, and that's www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org for the archive of this call and for information on upcoming sessions. Thanks for joining us today. This concludes today's Outlook Live webinar. Enjoy the rest of your day.